This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Okay, well, I'm so excited that Bill Larson from Larson & Larson is here, because we are going to be talking, I've had so many questions, and I am so happy to welcome you back to Joy on Paper. Bill, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Oh, well, I would assume that it's going to be a busy time for you. Many of the questions I have are about AI, but first I want to get to one listener. She's very anxious to hear what you say about photographers. She's now getting fairly well known. And she went, this is now like almost 10 years ago, she went and had her photographs taken by a local photographer.
Yes.
And you know how when you go and you select the two best ones, maybe, you know, and you buy them, you know, those are the ones that you take. But she said it was, you know, it was a long sort of process before they got the right one, and they took a lot of shots, she didn't like some, and she was making faces in some of them when she got silly. Nothing risque, she assures me, but she wants them back, and he is insisting that she has no right to them. So, first of all, she wants to make like some changes to them. She wants to like put them, you know, through some of these filters where you can make them different colors and stuff like that, sort of, you know, enhance them. And he's saying that they belong to him.
That's probably correct. So you have to go back and you have to look at the contract between the photographer and the person who paid the photographer. If the contract does not provide an assignment of copyright, then the photographer owns all copyright, which is the exclusive right to reproduce. So although you paid that photographer and you can have a physical photograph to take with you, that does not give you the right to reproduce it.
I was afraid of that, and that's what I sort of said to her, but I wasn't sure. And I mean, now you're clarifying it. So most people think, you know, that once, if they go, like in her case, she went to the photographer, as I said, a local, you know, at the time, certainly not a well-known photographer. He's still not a well-known photographer. But, you know, they took a lot of photos, and she took the ones that she liked the best to use on her book covers. But she can't take her own photo of herself and manipulate it, you know, or colorize it or do whatever she wants to it?
No, not unless she has an agreement from the photographer to do so.
See, most people don't know this. I mean, I don't know. I don't even know if you, I mean, I suppose they give you something to sign when you go into, you know, have your photo taken, but I don't think most people think about it.
They don't read it, they just sign it. And it either lacks a clause concerning copyright, or it has a clause concerning copyright that the photographer retains ownership.
So he can do whatever he wants with, is he allowed to use them in other places? I mean, is he allowed to? Now, as I said, we're hoping, you know, she's going to be famous at some point, maybe get a movie deal kind of for one of her books. And he can just take those photos and do whatever he wants with them, publish them where he wants. Is that right?
It depends on what's in the contract. If there's no contract at all, it was just a handshake, then likely, yes, he can use them. In the case of a person's appearance, there might be an argument by the individual that he cannot use that personal image in any commercial way. But other than that, he would be able to probably publish them, and that would be within his right.
And sell them and make money off of them?
Yes.
And she doesn't get anything?
Well, she would have to make the argument that the money that the photographer was making was a result of her personality, her appearance, and that she's entitled to a portion of that.
Well, this is she's going to be one unhappy person. So when she doesn't actually remember signing anything, he was advertising like a local magazine newspaper, and she went into his place of business, and he had a setup there, and he did, they just like you take your kids for photo shoots. You never think that maybe, I mean, if you took your kid in, like I took my kids in, some gorgeous shots of them, would he be able to sell those?
In absence of a contract saying otherwise, possibly yes.
So how do you get this contract? I mean, I think now people are going to want to say, I know authors have had a problem with book covers. They hire somebody to do a book cover, and then they want to do something else with the book cover. For example, if they have a book cover, are they allowed to take their book cover and put it on a T-shirt?
Possibly yes, if they own the copyright in it. It all depends on who owns the copyright. And because copyrights can only be assigned in writing, if you have a handshake deal, the author or the photographer retains ownership and copyright and can do whatever they want with the image.
Wow. This is something that most people don't know. I don't think authors here who are, always really working hard to get that right image for themselves, but then maybe if they become famous, it's sort of like, I suppose with movie stars, they do, photographers do sell their pictures when they were kids or when they were teenagers and had, So, yeah, is there a standard contract that people should get and can get? Can they get this contract from you, for example?
Yes. So all you need is a contract that says that the photographer transfers all right and copyright to the person who's paying. And that's all you need. It can be as much as one sentence in an email.
Okay, something like that. All right.
It can be that easy, yeah.
Yeah.
It just has to make clear in writing, and both parties agree, that the copyright, because the copyright automatically is owned by the person who pushes the shutter, who paints the picture, who draws, whatever it is you're paying them to do, they retain ownership of the copyright in absence of a written agreement otherwise.
Wow. Oh, this is something important that really all of you authors out there, you have to take this into consideration nowadays. There's so many things you have to take into consideration.
Well, it falls back to our discussion every month that, you've got to be careful with your contracts. If you get involved with somebody in a business transaction, then you need to read carefully or understand the law that you're getting involved in so that this doesn't happen.
And like you said, it could be one line in a email. And people don't understand. I have, as you have warned, and I always reiterate this to authors, never write in an email, never agree to anything that, somebody will send you and said, well, we want to represent you. You're one. Authors get all of this, spam mail where they're told, oh, we love this, your book, and we want to take it to a producer. Do you agree? And I've told authors, and I know you've told them, don't put anything in an email. Never say yes. Oh, yes, I'd love for you to, right?
Mm-hmm, 'cause you just created a contract.
Yeah. Oh, boy. It's always something out there. As if authors don't have enough problems. And one of those also is a question that has been asked, and you've answered it several times, about titles of books, not being able to copyright a title.
No, you can't copyright the title of a book.
So there could be, as I think I sent you an example of, like, I think there's 25 books on Amazon that are revenge. I mean, that's the title of the book, Revenge.
Yes.
And so,
you can't copyright or trademark protect the title of a single work. Now, if you have a series of works, Harry Potter, for example, then you can protect it, but it has to be in a series, not a single edition.
Okay. And again, with the title,
same goes for songs.
Yeah. Wow.
You can use the title of any song. You know, there's no protection in the title of a song.
Yes, there must be lots of songs called love.
No.
Oh well. Now, it all sort of comes around, and this is one of the things. Partly because of the AI, that this idea, she came out with this idea, she wants to, they have a program where you put your photograph in, an AI, like, does something to it, okay, colorizes it and whatever. So that she had been thinking about doing that, and that's why I said, well, I don't know if you own it. And so now she knows she doesn't own it, and so maybe the photographer is going to do that. Are you getting a lot of questions about AI? Authors don't know what it means to them. They have no idea. When AI, it's hard to comprehend. AI, obviously, whatever AI is, they've read millions of books, more books than me. You know, I've only read 12,000 books. And then they can mishmash it all together, right?
Correct.
But what if what they mishmash together comes out and sort of sounds like your book?
Yeah, then it could be an infringement, and that's the basis of the lawsuits that are going forward right now. Several class action cases arguing that the AI is using as a basis copyrighted works to create new works, and that constitutes infringement.
Well, I think it does. It's so horrible to think that an AI is going to write a book, and on top of it, I'm waiting for an AI to send me a book, because what am I going to do? You know, you have to get your mind around this, because this is very confusing. I know.
So if
one
AI
thing,
creates a book, you know, if AI writes a book or a text, or if AI creates an image, those are not protectable. You can't copyright them, and you can't sue people to stop them using them. Not protectable at this time.
Now, does Amazon, as you know, for Audible books, when you submit a narration for Audible books, they make you sign some kind of agreement that it is a real person.
Okay.
So what about Amazon? Do they insist that the books be submitted by a real person?
I don't know. I'm more tuned into the law rather than the arbitration rules of Amazon, which are constantly changing. But you can easily go on Amazon and ask and just read their intellectual property arbitration protocols and determine what each different seller uses as its rules and regulations.
Because I know Audible is very, very tough about that. You cannot submit, you know, any narration.
That would be a law. That would be a rules, you know.
Uh-huh.
I deal mostly in laws.
But then somewhere around, people start breaking the rules, and then they have to call you and get involved in a lawsuit, because people are completely confused by this.
Well, you can create images now that look real and are created by AI for specific uses, and people can be fooled or defrauded based on images or text created by AI. That's the big fear.
Well, a major publisher just apologized because they used a book cover that was created by AI. And they said that they did not know that the image was created by AI. And I'm hoping there was a big thriller fest going on up in New York this past weekend. And one of the things that they were discussing is how they can keep, particularly the major publishers, from using AI covers, because they're going to destroy the lives of illustrators for sure.
Well, AI is going to change the way almost everything works. So, for example, they're using AI in medicine now to analyze, let's say, MRIs and X-rays and all kinds of tests, and the AI can find things that a doctor would never see or a radiologist would never see. So, you know, the job of a radiologist may be going away because AI will now analyze the images. And the AI can see down to the nanoparticle size, where the human eye doesn't have that kind of resolution. So in the future, AI is going to be very useful in diagnosis in the medical industry. And a lot of people are going to lose their jobs because of it.
But AI is not perfect, because recently, didn't AI, in a legal opinion, cite cases that were made up?
I'm not specifically aware of that, but of course it is fallible. It's not perfect. Nothing's perfect.
I mean, how do you have an algorithm in there that's, if AI is going to cite legal cases, don't the legal cases have to be real?
You would think so, yes. And there, if the AI algorithms are correctly created, then it should weed out those fake cases and only use the cases that are real and are binding.
for you, have you been involved yet with any AI cases?
Yes, we are in the area of patenting.
Yeah. Well, that is a whole big field.
Yeah, it is, because AI is so much more efficient. It's basically a supercomputer. And it uses an enormous amount of data to come up with results. And this is what the computer did when it first came out years ago, solving mathematical problems and such. But it is going to be a great help in the scientific community to use AI.
Well, I'm really worried about what's going to happen here with illustrators, particularly. I think that is probably one of the easiest things for AI to take over, as we talked here about taking people's photographs and mushing them about and playing with them. They can do all sorts of things, and it's a sort of a scary world out there.
Yeah, well, whenever you have these changes in technology, people that used to, you know, hold those positions and do those jobs go away. That's what the engine did to the horse. This is just the way the world works.
But I predict that we will always have lawyers, because we will always, there will always be all of this sort of gray area that needs to be explored, and where people can find loopholes and laws if they have the right.
There's certain jobs that will not be erased by AI, but there will be a lot of jobs that will be lost because of AI, because the computer is just so much more efficient.
Well, you know, Bill, it's a strange new world for us with this whole AI thing, and I know that my listeners are a little bit worried about where it's headed. And I mean, I worry when they came out with some of these grammar programs that correct people's grammar, and
yep.
And
spell check.
Spell check, and recently I had a spell check, and this is terrible. The spell check came up and said, "Do you really want to say that?" And I thought, "Honey, yeah." I wrote it. That's what I want to say. I don't care if you don't like it. You know, I mean, it's getting really invasive.
And so AI will be able to generate novels, movies, and all kinds of things in the future.
Oh, wow. And they're already, I think that's part of the...
It's already being done.
Yeah, I think they're doing it with actors' faces. They make them, I don't know if that's AI, they make them look young. They take years
out. There's always been software. Well, there's always been software out there to modify images. But what AI is different is rather than just modify, it creates. So it can take just, you know, a person's thought or an idea and then put that into a picture, and the picture could look absolutely 100% real. And they're already doing it in the campaigns. There, some of the ads you'll see from the different people running for office are using AI, and they'll have a picture, for example, like San Francisco being burned down, or, you know, all these like crazy scary images, and they're all AI.
And you could just talk to, I mean, see, I wouldn't even put it on my computer. I don't want to know. I'm afraid of it. But in your life, do you now, like, do you chat with AI? Say, hey.
No, I don't yet.
No.
But we will in the near future.
Yeah, I guess so. Anyway, meanwhile, we can hope that a lot of people will just continue writing. And if you're writing, I want you to remind people again to let them know that they should keep a record of their writing and save it and preserve it.
Correct. Always date and sign your work as you're going along, either in a computer file or if you're still pen and paper, you know, write that down. Date it and keep it secure, so that if there's ever a question later whether it was AI and it was in fact you who wrote it, you have evidence.
Okay, well, Bill Larson, thank you so much for joining me today. I think a lot of authors out there are going to be shaking a little bit today when they discover that those photographs don't belong to them and they can't do what they want with them. So again, it's always a joy to talk to you, and they can contact you at Larson and Larson, and it's LarsonPatentLaw.com, right?
Yep, LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Okay, Bill. Again, thank you so much for joining me today.
It was a pleasure.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Wow. Okay, we'll have some commercials, and then I'm going to be back with a very special guest today. Very special.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with a very, very special guest. This is so fantastic. Joe R. Lansdale is going to be talking and talking because I could listen to him for hours. And the name of his book that is coming out, it's called Things Get Ugly, The Best Crime Stories of J.R. Lansdale. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you?
Wow. I just love talking to you. As a matter of fact, you can just whisper in my ear all day long.
Thank you.
Well, your wife Karen is very lucky. She can hear you all the time, just blabbing away.
Thank you very much.
Wow. This new book, of course, it's a collection of your wonderful, wonderful stories. And I just want to say one thing as I'm reading them. My sister-in-law raises chickens, and she has a chicken house. And she tells me that she would not let Uncle Smat. She would not put his body in her chicken house because she loves her chickens and she doesn't think that would be right.
I can understand that. She's a good chicken raiser. These people apparently were not.
obviously. That is just one of the many, many fantastic stories in this book. Tell us where you came out with Uncle Smat.
Well, Uncle Smat, actually, I heard a story about some people who actually murdered someone way back, and it was always maybe an apocryphal story, but they buried them in the chicken house because they thought people would not, consider someone burying somebody in the chicken house because the chicken floor was, shall we say, covered with chicken excrement.
Well, actually, that's, it's a good place because when you think about it.
It's based on a true story, as I'm told, but it could be apocryphal. But whatever it was, it stuck with me. And I just sort of put it back in the files, and I said, okay, this is going to be part of a story someday. And it is. It's a small part, but I like to think it's a memorable part.
Oh, it's memorable, all right. And when you think about it, actually, it would. The cadaver dogs would get all confused. They might not find that body.
That's true. They might not want to look.
That's true. And that's in a story called Driving to Geronimo's Grave. It's such a great story. There's so many things about it. But what I love, when Mama tells Chauncey, she tells him to go up to Oklahoma to get Uncle Smat's body, and he said, well, I haven't been there. And she says, just drive north.
Yeah, right. Just take that road and go. The thing that I thought about all of these stories, well, not all, but most of them, they're somehow connected to real events or real interests. There's a story about Mr. Bear, which has reminiscent of Smokey Bear, and that's because my wife and I, we have, on our wall, a framed Smokey Bear comic, because when we were kids, we were both members of the Smokey Bear Rangers. And so that was kind of the jumping off for a story that has absolutely nothing to do with that outside of having a bear mascot.
Well, all of your stories, it's just so much fun to read these stories. People who have not had this experience of reading your work are in for a big treat. Now, I could just take a half hour to tell people about who you are and about all the prizes you won, but why don't you tell people? Because I prefer your voice. I love your voice.
Well, okay, thank you. No, I've been fortunate enough to have won some recognitions and awards over the year. I think I have Ken Bram Stoker from the Horror Writers Association and the Grandmaster Award. I have the Edgar Award from the Mystery Writers, the Spur Award from the Western Writers, and the Herodotus Award from Historical Writers, and Fantasy, I think it's called the Heat Pot Award for Lifetime Achievement. I mean, there's a lot. I've done a lot. And when I was a kid, it was comic books that got me into this. I was about 4 years old, and my sister-in-law bought me a bunch of comic books because she and my brother were quite a bit older than me. He was 17 years older, And I think she was 15 years older. And so she gave me these comics, and I learned to read from those comics, and I wanted immediately to write comic books. I didn't think of it as a career because I didn't know anything about a career, but those stories I wanted to write so bad, some kind of comic book. And then I was reading all these different comic books, and I came across Classic Illustrated, and they had like all kinds of stories from you know, classic novels and classic short stories, and that sort of changed my direction. But to me, I can't remember not wanting to do this, and I can't remember not filing ideas, stories I've heard, you know, things I've experienced into my sort of little mental file department. And so when I got ready to tell a story, I always had and still have a tremendous amount of material there.
Well, you have one heck of a mind. The things go on in that mind of yours.
Yeah. My wife says, doesn't it kind of scare you as all those ideas? She said, no, I'm the one to be afraid of.
Well, it is so much fun. And the thing is, your stories are so memorable. Once people read your work, they never get your work confused with other writers. Although I noticed that, you know, they're comparing you now to Walt Whitman. And,
well, I mean, that's extreme. It's nice, but it's extreme.
Definitely Elmore Leonard. Mm-hmm. Wow. And, you know, when I think of you, I do come out always with these memories. I remember when I read The Thicket. Now, yeah. I got such a kick out of that opening. When people talk about, well, you know, you have to have a good opening. And then we have, I'm sorry, it's not funny. How did Grandma go?
I don't remember. Isn't that weird? I don't remember.
Oh my God. I mean, I can actually see that page in my mind because Grandma was kicked by a cow.
Oh, that's right. I had it in my head it was a mule, and I wasn't going to say because I didn't think that was right.
Oh,
but
no.
Yes, she was.
No.
She was kicked by a cow. And, yeah, you know, that one's about to be, is a film already. It's about to come out on Tubi, The Thicket, with Peter Dinklage and Juliette Lewis.
Well, I'm glad because now that is one memorable. I remember reading that because my grandma
I read somewhere a long time ago that most of the time the whole novel that you're actually writing is pretty well defined in the earliest sentences or the earliest paragraph. And when I look at that opening paragraph, that's pretty much everything that's going to happen in a nutshell, but then you get to take the shell off and really, you know, look inside and see all the, you know, how it came about, which is, of course, the fun of writing and reading a novel. But that opening paragraph, which I thought was interesting, when I look at it, and I kind of analyze it. It does. And everything that is going to be in the story is there.
It is. And I didn't know it was being turned into a film. But
yeah,
now I don't remember.
October 6th.
I don't remember how long ago I read that. I don't remember when it came out. But that stayed with me partly because my grandma had a goat. And if anybody was going to get killed, it would have been Grandpa, because that goat hated my grandfather. He would chase my grandfather up a tree. My grandfather would, you'd sometimes find him sitting up there on a branch of a apple tree, and they'd say, "What are you doing up there?" And he'd say, "You know, Grandma's
the goat chased me up a tree.
Peck us up.
We raised goats."
Yeah,
my wife and I had a goat dairy when we first got married, and we did that for about 2 years. And so I'm familiar with goats and all kinds of farm animals because I grew up in the country. And then when my wife and I married, we did that for a while until she could get to where she could finish her degree, and I could get to where I could start writing. Well, and start selling my writing. I was already writing, but I remember we had that goat dairy. We'd have to get up before daylight, go out, milk the goats, feed the goats, take care of the chickens, all the other animals and stuff like that. And you know, it's a real job. You know, people talk about the good old days, but the good old days were rough.
They certainly were, and I do know about chasing goats, and I used to bring in the cows for my grandfather.
Yep.
And of course fed the chickens all the time. You know, with your accent, I'm surprised that you were raised in the country and not Brooklyn, but
yeah, well, I definitely was raised in the country. My parents, well, my father anyway, his side of the family had been sharecroppers. My mother, they always worked in some kind of sales or something like that. But you know, I grew up around people who knew something about farming and knew something about farm animals, and I didn't know anywhere near what they knew. But I plowed with mules. We had 4 acres, and we used that to make a sort of not only food for us, but I guess what we called truck cropping, which meant things that you could carry to market in a pickup. And I sold to a health food store. We were organic gardeners, farmers, and then I worked part time in the rose fields, although it seemed like more than part time. I did a lot of the jobs that my characters in the Happ and Leonard books did.
And let's talk a little bit about Happ and Leonard, because I think most people know you from that, and of course know you from the books and know you from the series. So tell us, yeah. Tell us some stuff about Happ and Leonard that we don't know yet.
Well, what you don't know, I've just turned in a new book. I will say that, a new Happ and Leonard book called Sugar on the Bone, and I think it's one of the best Happ and Leonard books. It brings a lot of the characters that have been introduced or have appeared frequently in the books all together in one book. And so there's a lot of changes going on in their life and career, and there are a lot of new factors, but there's still, I think, that same old storytelling verb, I like to believe, comes with those. And but a few years back, Jim Mickle and Nick DiMicci decided that they wanted to make a television series out of Happ and Leonard. They'd already made a movie out of my novel, Cold in July. And so it ended up on the Sundance Channel. It was their most popular show all 3 seasons. But it got canceled anyway because Sundance didn't have a big audience because it was Sundance. And then it moved to Netflix and was there several years. And then now it's on AMC Plus. But I think they did a very good job of capturing my characters, and played by James Purefoy and the late Michael K. Williams. And they had, you know, great guests in the series, you know, like Christina Hendricks and Irma Hall, who I liked a whole lot, you know, and just Luke Gossett. I mean, the list goes on. And so they had, you know, great actors, and they had mostly, I thought, good scripts. I wrote one of them for the second season. So they've been represented on TV and in books and in film. They first appeared in 1990, I think, or 1991. But they were really different back then for readers, because one was black, Republican, and gay, and the other one was a white, liberal, and I guess you would say sort of a ne'er-do-well, not by choice, but by choices that he had made. He was a Vietnam War resister, things like that, that made them very unlikely to be together, but they both worked the same kind of jobs. They both lived in the same kind of place. They both spent time in the rose fields with each other, and they became good friends. And over time, they actually became brothers, and they're as close as family. But over the years, too, I've had new things happen to them. I've had new events change them, and yet they're always involved in some sort of crime, adventure, or mystery. Eventually, they went to work for a private eye agency. And then that private eye agency was sold to the woman that became Happ's wife. So there have been, you know, been a lot of changes. But those books, when I first wrote them, the idea of a black Republican was actually odd and unusual. And a black gay conservative back then was very unusual. And the fact that these guys had what some people called an unlikely friendship in East Texas, wasn't something you were seeing every day in other people's work. It doesn't mean nothing like it had ever been done, but nothing like it had been done consistently over that period of time, you know. And I was glad at how people took to it. I've had people say that changed their views on race on homosexuality and all those things because of those books. And if they achieve nothing else, I'm proud of that. But I like to think they're really entertaining.
Oh, they are. They are. And that's, I mean, that's why people love them. It's as you said, the series great. Did I think, you know, usually on a set, people, you know, when I worked in Hollywood, when I'd be on a set, they never wanted, I adapted some films, some books for film. And they never really wanted the writer to come on the set.
No, most of the time they don't. I've been fortunate, and we did, with Don Coscarelli, did a film based on my story, Bubba Hotep. And it was a crazy film, but I loved it. Bruce Campbell, Ossie Davis. And my son and I were on the set for that when they did Cold in July. My whole family came in shifts, kind of, and were on the set and enjoyed being there. And my daughter actually had some music in Cold in July. She's a musician. And then the Happy Leonard set, for the first season, I was on there, you know, almost all of it. I visited the set in the third season. But when they did The Thicket, I was not consulted at all. But, you know, I didn't write the screenplay. I didn't have anything to do with it outside of writing the source material and deals being made with my great agent out in California, Ryan Lipson. He handled that, and I think I maybe had a couple conversations with the director. Nice guy, but I wasn't as involved in that one, and it felt different, you know, unlike the others, because I feel like I was truly a part of those. But most of the time, you're correct. They don't want the writer on set. If we manage to do what I hope to do, which I hope to direct the film next year, based on a story of mine scripted by my son, who did a wonderful script, if that works, I'll have him on the set.
Well, you know, I think any time that somebody's shooting a film, I don't care what they're shooting, they could be shooting a film about Romans, and they'd love to have you on the set just because everybody loves to hear you talk.
Well, you know, I had so much fun on the set of all those things, and I've been on a lot of other sets that weren't my material. I was also on the set of Incident on and Off of Mountain Road, which Showtime did, and so I've been on most of the sets. I've been happy with most of the films. I can't speak for The Thicket because it hasn't come out yet. I haven't seen it. But I've also, you know, had a lot of things optioned that I wasn't on the set for because they never got made. Or if they got made, they were animated. So I wasn't on the set for those. Because I wrote animation for Batman, the animated series, and I wrote one for Superman, the animated series. I wrote a long length animated Son of Batman. I did a thing with produced by George R.R. Martin based on a Howard Waldron story called Night of the Tudors. And I adapted that one for about 30 minutes. And it's a mixture of live action and animation. And I was on the set for that one. Vincent D'Onofrio starred in it and directed it.
Oh, so I love him.
Oh, I do too. He's great. And he did a wonderful job. And I would like to, in the future, I'd hope to work with him again. We'll see.
Well, you are. It's just, as I said, it would be delightful to have you just about anywhere in the world. Just, I could go to Paris with you and sit there outside on the Champs-Élysées and just listen to you talking all day long.
Yeah, thank you. That's very kind of you. Well, that'd be a nice place to be, you know. I'm a big Italian fan. I love going to Italy. Our daughter is there right now with her boyfriend, Jonathan Levitt, who's an amazing magician. And she's signing a book that she and I wrote stories for. And, you know, so it kind of like runs in the family, which really helps because we're all interested in the same things. We're all working for each other's progress and success. So to me, that's wonderful, and what made me think of it was the travel, because we started traveling together as a family when we were, you know, when we were younger, and they were kids, and they have continued to do so. the writing's been good to us. You know, I certainly say that.
Oh, that's for sure. It's been good to you. And you've been good for all the readers out there. And when I was thinking about the Champs-Élysées, because my husband, when we lived in Europe, he always wore a cowboy hat. Well, he wore cowboy clothes, suits and boots and the cowboy hat. And we had such a wonderful time in Europe because wherever we'd go, when he was dressed like that, they would give us the best seats and the best service. Absolutely. So it was lots of fun. And, of course, he didn't have your accent. He was from Israel, but he adapted. He just loved that look, and so that's what we had. And wow, I think you're so fantastic. I think you must blush a lot because
I do.
Yeah, you do because everybody is praising you, and of course our friend Larry Block says such nice things about you. I mean, that's
Larry, he's wonderful.
I was so thrilled the first time that I got to talk to you was because you were in one of Larry's anthologies, and I love all of your short stories in here. You come out with great titles, and your character names, I mean, they are just so good. I like Chauncey.
Yeah.
I sure do, and I'm glad he head north, Chauncey. You'll find Oklahoma eventually.
That's one of my favorite stories I've ever written, and it's one of those things how stories come so oddly is I was asked to do that for an anthology, and the whole thing was you just had to be based around cars. And so they had this car that they went in to get Matt's body, and that's all I had was really the car and that old idea about the chicken house, and the whole story came together. And I mean, even as someone who writes these things, I'm always amazed at how fragments and pieces and general ideas, because I don't plot. I don't sit down and write out plots and outlines and because by the time I do that, I no longer want to do the story. So I just kind of find the story. But that was the emphasis. That was it. It was the whole idea of a car and that story I'd heard about burying a body in a chicken.
I mean, just for that story alone, this book is worth it. And it's going to be coming out in August. And everybody, you have to pre-order it because that's a lovely thing to do for authors. It's a kind thing to do. And when you get this book, you'll just sit down and you'll read. And it's funny, as you're reading it, I found myself sort of imitating your voice in many places because I start thinking in the way that, first of all, you come out with the most wonderful character names. They really just flow. You know, I just love it.
Well, thank you. I can't take credit for all that because a lot of them are just names I heard growing up or people I've known. And, it's just little bits and pieces here. You know, Chauncey DeVega, as a friend of mine, has a podcast, and so I use Chauncey's first name for the pair.
Well, that is it is so clear when I was reading that story. Of all the stories in the book, I said to myself, he really had fun writing this story.
Oh, I do. I have fun writing my stories. His sister, Chauncey's sister, was my favorite character. And she was such an unusual sort of, she saw things as they were. And sometimes she was a little mean-spirited, but I really enjoyed writing about her a lot. I've written a lot of stories where I've had young adults and women and as characters and girls as characters. And I've loved doing that because I had such a strong mother and a strong wife and my daughter. And I've been, I have a niece, Pam, the same way. So many of those people have inspired me so much that I love writing from that viewpoint.
And
if I get it wrong, I get it wrong.
And you don't get it wrong. And things get ugly. The best crime stories of Joe R. Lansdale. This is a wonderful book. It's just It's a book that you're going to sit down, you're going to read it once, then you're going to have your favorite ones, you're going to go back and read them a couple of times, and you get to know these characters. Joe, I think you're terrific. I'm just so honored that you're on Joanne Paper today, because...
Well, I'm honored to be here.
Because
thank you for having me.
You're very special. You know, people will say, well, what's his style? And all people have to know is whatever comes out of that brilliant mind of his. that's the style. I think people could just, you know, somebody could come by you, just sort of tap you on the head and say, Joe, come out with a new story, and you could do it.
Well, you know, once I was going to do something under a pen name, for whatever reason, I don't remember. But people, my editors were saying, well, why do that? As soon as they read a paragraph, they're going to know who it is.
That's absolutely true. You have a very special style, and maybe there's a touch of Walt Whitman in there. There's an area there where you're sort of writing a little bit like poetry, and definitely you've got the humor, you've got the warm-heartedness of some of the stories. You know, there's crime stories, but you always find something special in people, and this is a terrific book.
Thank you.
Well, I guess you've got a website. What is it?
I do. www.joerlansdale, you know, it's the website. But I have a fan page. I don't actually do Facebook. You have to have one to have the fan page, but I never go on it. But there is a fan page on Facebook, and I'm on Twitter. And my daughter handles for me an Instagram account.
Well, Joe, I think you're terrific. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
And I think you're delightful. Absolutely delightful. And Karen is a very lucky woman that she can listen to you all the time.
All right. Well, thank you so much for having me.
Okay. Bye-bye now, Joe. Bye.
Bye.
Oh, he's so true. These stories are amazing. They are so good. Everybody, if you get this book, and all of you writers out there, if you don't read this book, you're crazy, because this is an example of brilliant writing, and he is so good, and just amazing. So I am so thrilled with that. Oh, I had a wonderful time reading that book. I always have a wonderful time reading books, and I want to again thank him for joining me today. And now we learned something here very important from Bill Larson, our legal eagle. Oh boy, be careful what you write, be careful what you say on social media. Don't put anything that you don't want published. So anyway, everybody, have a wonderful time reading books this weekend. What else? Oh, yes, because one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel, like I'm hoping for Carol J. Perry and Haunted Haven Mysteries, because they're set right here in my backyard, and I would love if they would be filming here, because like Joe, I love being on a set. It's lots of fun. And Carol J. Perry would be crazy happy if she was on the set of one of her mysteries being shot here. Anyway, say something nice to somebody today. I will say something nice to Big Ed. And thank you, Ed, for everything. He saluted me, and I saluted him. And it's going to be D-Day soon. Everybody, if you want a great book, get Omar Bradley by Jim DeFelice. It is a perfect book for D-Day. Absolutely great. My dad served under Omar Bradley, and he was the GI's general and a great guy. So, everybody, have a lovely, lovely weekend. Bye-bye now.